This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is March 7th, 2024.
I'm Scott Lindebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, Selena Robinson quits the BC NDP, I guess the NDP broadly, as your membership is tied, kind of throws fireballs on her way out. A battle brews in Vancouver Little Mountain, a less fractious one for the BC NDP. And the federal government is looking to devolve immigration to local governments and a few other little stories. It was a week where one thing happened and a bunch of other little things. So we will talk about the thing. Go to patreon.com/politicoast and support this podcast and give us a few bucks to help us grow if you can. Let's talk about how Selena Robinson celebrated her birthday. I still can't believe that.
Was it her birthday?
It was her birthday yesterday.
Huh.
And she decides on her birthday to quit the party and release this long letter to caucus that is now public and was probably always going to be public, where she slams her former colleagues, many by name, as either having done anti-Semitic things in her opinion or facilitated a culture that was anti-Semitic towards her. And she was frustrated by her interactions with David Eby, the premier, and decided that she felt she could better serve her constituents as an independent for the last few months. And that's how she went out. And what a way to leave after everything. Where do you even want to start with this, Scott?
I mean, I always kind of suspected that we had not heard the last word on this after the resignation. I didn't necessarily expect it would come out so soon, but in some ways this doesn't feel like a surprise to me. This is obviously a broad issue that has some pretty heated feelings on all sides on, so it's not unexpected that it came bubbling up and that there were some lingering resentments all around this. So the letter itself is 5 pages. It goes into several different allegations, some stronger than others. But I think the broad theme of Selena Robinson's criticism is that there was a double standard in place on this, and that how one would expect a government, and particularly one that sees itself as progressive, would respond to a rather violent massacre, that's a redundant term, how they would respond to an atrocity such as October 7th towards a historically marginalized people, and then a series of hateful incidents that had increased in frequency in the aftermath of that. Was not how they responded in this case, and that there was a double standard at play here. In addition, she cites several incidents of cases where, you know, an apology for statements that were considered offensive or specifically anti-Semitic was generally considered sufficient to allow the person who said them to kind of come back into the NDP fold and continue on serving in the party and in elected office, and that she feels she was not afforded the same leeway or ability to basically apologize and continue on, and that there was the sanctions that fell on her were a lot more strict than the sanctions that fell on other members of the party who had in the past said offensive things.
I think that's where I read her highlighting it as a double standard. I think the other theme I get from her in there is that she didn't feel supported, or that this government took her concerns on behalf of the Jewish community seriously. in a number of different ways. Yeah.
Trying to get at a bit with kind of how one would expect a government to respond to something just like abstracted out on away from the specifics of the last several months and everything that's happened there. That just in general, how governments and particularly progressive ones respond to bigotry, hateful incidents, violence around the world directed at marginalized groups. There's a certain structure that typically takes, and you didn't see that here.
Her biggest frustration at the start, I see as she lays it out, is that kind of two things didn't happen for her. One, there was a memorial in Vancouver fairly shortly after October 7th, and only a couple NDP MLAs came out from the island, and most were silent. And within caucus, she says she sent out a strong email and didn't get too many replies, or didn't get any replies back until Aman Singh and Katrina Chen, she says, decided it was appropriate to, quote, reply all to my initial email asking folks to stand with the Jewish community and ask that the government make a public statement about the plight of Palestinians. And kind of goes on from there. She was hoping people would have called them out, but they didn't. And she doesn't refer to that as anti-Semitic specifically. She does go down on site a letter in December from Coquitlam Teachers Association that she alleges was rife with rhetoric, misinformation, and lies about the modern state of Israel, which we can't judge because it's not on their website anymore. She asked what
it's other... considered offensive enough that it got taken down, but yeah,
or at least
see the specifics.
They didn't want to deal with the backlash. It's not on their website, so she says. Finn Donnelly, when she asked him about the letter, he's my MLA, he said he was going to do nothing and ignore it. Going forward, she alleges Mabel Elmore kind of comes with the strongest. She references a 2004 statement that she made before she was in politics when she was a union leader, alleging that there were vocal Zionists in her worksite who opposed Elmore's anti-war activism. Carol James in 2009 apologized and disavowed those comments, and Elmore did issue an apology at the time that wasn't widely accepted. And then Robinson references a recent 2-minute statement in November by Elmore that alarmed the community again of Mabel's anti-Semitism. And someone pulled up what the best they could figure that was, and it was a statement where she called pretty much for a ceasefire and called the situation in the Middle East bad.
I thought that was the weakest part.
I find it undermines the letter to start referring to situation claims like that in the same breath.
The 2004 one?
The more recent.
Fair to take that, take issue with that. The more recent one in November, I mean, maybe the snippet that got pulled out wasn't the actual one I was referring to, but it's a little vague specifically on that. So, yeah, we stand to be corrected on that. But, yeah, it's not great. It's maybe one of those things where, you know, once you've burned some of your credibility on this, it's hard to, or people don't give you the benefit of the doubt, and she may not be giving Mabel the benefit of the doubt on this one.
She also accuses Jennifer Whiteside of sharing in 2012, 2014, and 2016 articles that were critical of Israel, one from the website Electronic Intifada, one that accused Israel of pinkwashing their acceptance of the LGBTQ2S community, and one that promoted the BDS movement. So ones that are on the left fairly, as I read her description, fairly standard criticisms of Israel on the left that aren't necessary. Unless we're getting into the realm that any and all criticism of Israel becomes anti-Semitism, I find those ones also weak in here.
I mean, it doesn't specifically say what the content from the Electronic Intifada was, but yeah, just the name does not exactly signal a... It definitely hints that it could very well be incredibly problematic.
So Electronic Intifada is a Chicago-based publication that is a nonprofit providing Palestinian perspective on the the long conflict. Some that are more pro-Israel really hate it. Others have found it as more moderate or at least interesting and bring in another perspective. It's not just some random blog, at least.
Right. But it's also worth remembering that, particularly to Jewish and Israeli people, the term Intifada connotes the second Intifada in particular, where there was a multi-year string of terrorist attacks, bus bombings, etc. It is not an uncomplicated term to title your publication.
No, and it's not clear that Whiteside necessarily endorsed that, but more maybe found the content of the article.
Right, but I think if a politician from a different party had shared content from a publication that in its name invoked Kristallnacht, for example, I think people would understandably take issue with that, regardless of the actual content of the article.
Except Palestinians aren't Nazis, Scott, and that's part of the problem.
No,
here.
But the it is specifically using a title that references a violent terrorism campaign is incredibly problematic.
It's a Arabic word that means rebellion or uprising. Would I use it? No. Can I see why a Palestinian who doesn't necessarily support violence might have used it? Yes. In the same way that...
At the same time, I think we can understand why...
Sure.
A Jewish person would take umbrage at that being used.
Moving on, because Robinson's list isn't done, this is the other thing. It's impressive to me she has this list of outrages that her peers have committed. It's weird, especially when a lot of them are old. A lot of these date back 20 years, the Mabel Elmore comment, or some of them are 10 years old, which doesn't tell you a lot about the status of caucus right now, other than the lack of direct support. Although it seems like Robinson's been carrying an axe on this, maybe justifiably, but that can create tensions where people don't feel like copying her or replying to her emails. It sounds toxic, everyone hated everyone. She next goes after Ronna Rae Leonard, who said she invited people to support Hanin Zubi, who was a Palestinian member of the Knesset in Israel. Robinson said Zubi negated the existence of Israel. As far as I could tell, Zubi supported a single state solution where Israel would be a secular state where there would be equal rights for Jews and Palestinians. Maybe that negates the state of Israel as it exists right now, but I also don't believe in ethno states, if I'm going to be honest. So call me the same then. Oh, she also compared the police to Nazis in 2013, Ronna Rae Leonard compared the police to Nazis in 2013. This brings us to the next section, which is all of the awkward Nazi comparisons people have made, which were mostly just dumb. Jagrat Brar quoted Goebbels in 2020, using the "if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it" comment. He did apologize for that and retracted it. She says that was sufficient. I think that, and similarly, Janet Rutledge apologized for comments of Holocaust minimization by comparing the criticism by the official opposition to Nazi rhetoric by saying, "The Holocaust ended in death camps, but started with words." Again, it's the don't refer to the Nazis ever. Don't compare things to the Nazis. I do think there is a significant difference between these kind of comments that were made where they apologized quickly and recognized the harm versus the deeply problematic and racist and Islamophobic rhetoric that Robinson was called out for in her speech that she did not offer a full-throated apology to initially. And that's where I don't think there actually is a double standard here. I think she's throwing her colleagues under the bus to try to, I don't even know, salvage her reputation on her way out. I do believe she is sad and, like, as she says, and is leaving with a broken heart. And this is, you know, frustrating for everyone involved. But what an ugly way to do it, to just, like, start naming all your colleagues by first name and being like, and Mabel's a bleeding anti-Semite. And you're like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, it's, I mean, this is definitely the end of her time in elected office, that's for sure. Definitely after this. This is a very clear, the bridges are being burned way out. I'm less convinced that there isn't a double standard here, but thoughts on what we're going to be able to hash out in the next few minutes, so just keep on going on this. But yeah, it's the whole thing's a giant mess on it. Without delving too much into any one specific, like, it does, I think, kind of show just how challenging it has been for particularly parties on the left to navigate these issues. And this really does seem like one where the parties have yet to find a way that actually satisfies all sides on any of this.
For the party's response, first, Ravi Kalone responded. I don't have his comments in front of me, he said, but it was along the lines of, he's sorry that this had to come out this way. Sorry she felt she had to leave, that kind of thing. David Eby said something very similar in his. And George Heyman also said that, you know, as a Jew, I did see some had initially said as a non-practicing Jew, but he is still a Jewish member of caucus who I didn't know. I forgot that there we had more than, for a while I was thinking Selena Robinson was the sole Jewish MLA, but I don't actually know. We don't often talk about religion in politics, or at least the religious beliefs of individual politicians in this country, for better, I think, for the most part. But each of EB and Heyman said that their experiences in the NDP don't match Robinson's, although I think everyone acknowledged, like, everyone's entitled to their perspective on how things come about, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily match their own view of how all of these situations played out. If, yeah. On the opposition side, the BC Conservatives, I think yesterday afternoon, were saying David Eby needs to resign. The BC United, Kevin Falcon, said they need to launch an inquiry into themselves, which, I mean, Labour in the UK did that and it went terribly. So I don't know why you'd do that. I think, you know, they can do more work internally, but promising to do like a public reaming of yourself, it's not going to make anyone happy.
Well, I mean, parties never like to do hard internal work.
God, they don't even like to do public inquiries of, like, the previous governments. It took a while to get any of those going.
But it's definitely more measured than calling for the premier to resign, which, that is the big guns. And, like, you really should only pull that out when there's, you know, a true, like, epic scandal and not just a very messy intra-party fight. There are accusations flying back and forth. But yeah, no, the BC United was a lot more measured on this one. They also highlighted six cases that they say were brought to the attention of the premier of anti-Semitic incidents within the public service, such as a Jewish member of the public service being told they were not allowed to wear a Star of David necklace during a team meeting, and that it was because it would make people uncomfortable and is a, quote, symbol of genocide, as well as that other members of the public service had phrases of "from the river to the sea," beside Palestinian flags in their
It was like in their Slack profile or whatever, their Teams profile.
Yeah, it was on Teams for intermissary meetings. So this sounds like a Microsoft Teams meeting.
Yeah.
They had that on either their display name or in the background. It's a little unclear.
These are all a little unclear. Like they're all, I have no clue where they got these, but it seems
All of these, if substantiated, are problematic. And like at this point, they're just accusations, but the sort that absolutely should be looked into. And if necessary, disciplinary actions taken on that.
Yeah, a number of them are more just the staff or senior employees or the union is seeing or has started land acknowledgements with statements about Palestine and things like that. And I think we really need to not allege that saying that Palestine exists is anti-Semitic. Some of these go farther, but some of them are.
It was more that wasn't so much that. I'm not sure it's appropriate to really be throwing in stuff that are about a conflict on the other side of the world.
That's different issue,
just,
right?
Like, there's in general, this is outside the scope of the public service and should probably just be left off of that on that front. Some of them also do go well beyond that, including stuff that is anti-Semitic, such as that Jewish people are not indigenous to the region. And obviously that's incorrect and anti-Semitic. But
that's not in there, though. Which one is that?
Is it? Let me see.
There's one where they say a DEI training included a diatribe that was false and prejudiced against Jews about how they colonized Palestine. And as civil servants, we should stand with Palestine.
It's the bottom one here, which denies the fact that Jews are indigenous to Israel.
Right. It goes on to say we were there before Muslims, which is alternatively problematic thing to say. Like, I agree that in pretty much all of these, there's definitely an issue if people are using their, public service work profiles to express political statements. Let's dial that back in all cases. The person who was told not to wear their Star of David necklace, I'm giving the benefit of doubt that this is most likely the standard one and not someone wearing a weird Israeli flag necklace, which would be a bit more political. That person should not have been told not to wear that. This isn't Quebec. We don't have a ban on religious symbols. You can wear your cross or your Star of David fine. There's also in all of these kind of allegations against the union. In a couple of them, they're like, my manager said the union won't care, which I'm like, your manager's like, just like the inherent dynamic of a workplace is managers are against the union in any case. But maybe the union was getting too political or wasn't doing enough to make sure that Jewish members also felt safe in it. So there's more to do in here, although I think there does need to be an understanding, right, that the dynamics of the caucus are separate. Like the civil service is independent of the BCNDB caucus. It's even independent of the premier's office, although the government does have a responsibility to ensure its oversight.
Yeah, and it's, I think the bigger question here, the one that this alludes to, is what is the culture that is being set by the government in that oversight function?
But a lot of these do sound like issues that could arise at any larger employer where you have
potentially
people.
Yeah.
That's not to justify it, but it is to say these are the same kind of challenges and difficulties that everyone is navigating in a way that we should hope our government does better. I did see as well, Katie DeRosa asked BC United if they were going to welcome Selena Robinson to the caucus. Falcon said he's reached out to her about joining, but he wouldn't elaborate on those discussions.
I mean, I can see Kevin Falcon wanting to bring Robinson on. I'm having a hard time seeing why Robinson would join.
Yeah.
It
would make her re-election quite difficult, but she's got...
She's not going to win as an independent, but at this point, joining BC United could potentially be as big a death, political death sentence as running as an independent.
The BC Liberals took 28% of the vote in Coquitlam-Mallardville in the last election. The one in 2017, they took 37%. It was close in 2013, but they just lost it, the Liberals.
And they're going to take a bigger schlacking this time.
They
for sure.
have last won it in 2020 or in 2001 when Richard Stewart, who went on to become mayor of Coquitlam, took it. And that's actually the only time it's not been NDP since 1986 when the constituency was created, or at least Wikipedia goes back to. So,
yeah, also the party is bleeding support every time a new poll comes out.
Indeed. So, like, Robinson has some local popularity. She was a city councillor in Coquitlam, and I understand relatively popular, although there's always been people who've not liked her locally and, I guess, in the BCNDP. But, like, I have to believe she's honest in really just wanting to quit. I can't see why she wouldn't want to at least take a break.
Yeah, and also, like, besides this one issue, like, there doesn't seem to be a lot of overlap between her positions and that of BC United.
I've heard that she was more on the hawkish side when she was finance minister, and that's part of why EB wanted her out of there, among other things, but
yeah, maybe.
I don't know if, like, she's BC United level of hawkish.
Yeah. Well, this isn't in our show notes, but, like, there was a recent piece by Trevor Toome, The Economist, about how BC is, like, on the most unstable one of the most unstable fiscal tracks of any of the provinces, and that is a fairly recent change that's only come about last couple budgets. So I don't know. She may have been onto something on that.
Well, from Robinson to Heyman, who we mentioned. His announcement this week, which was the bigger news of the party until Selena Robinson took the spotlight, was that he is not going to contest the next election. And immediately, candidates started lining up to compete for the Vancouver Little Mountain riding, which would have been where he would have too, but yeah, prominent
as in
ones.
Like within an hour of the announcement. Yeah.
He didn't even get to say goodbye before Andrea Reimer was like, I'm in. And then everyone's like, Christine Boyle's in too.
Yes.
Worst kept secret.
So clearly this is not a well-kept secret among the party.
Yeah.
At all. If they had time to, at least in Reimer's case, line up endorsements, both had time to get websites up. Like, it was clearly this had been in the works.
Yeah. And so this seems like a pretty safe snap for the NDP. If we're talking about how Coquitlam-Mallardville has only gone liberal once in the past 30 years.
I mean, just with where the polling is, it's hard to think of a seat that has a retiring NDP MLA that isn't going to be a fairly safe one if you can get the nomination.
Yeah, and speaking of, one of the challenges in Vancouver Little Mountain is the BC NDP's equity mandate applies, as there is a retiring MLA, and so it has to go to a member of an equity seeking group. And there's been some fine tuning to that recently. I actually am now very curious if Coquitlam-Mallardville is subject to the equity mandate, because it would have to go to a woman, having had a woman MLA step down, but now it's an independent. So is it an open riding? Question for the party nerds who know how this works. But in Vancouver Little Mountain, both Christine Boyle and Andrea Reimer qualify under the equity mandate. What's really interesting here is both our current or past Vancouver City councillors. Christine Boyle, many listeners will know, is with One City and kind of the progressive, the left candidate, the left urbanist councillor on Vancouver City Council. Andrea Reimer was with Vision Vancouver, and I believe with the Vancouver Greens prior to that, but that was when she was on Park Board, the first Green elected in Canada. Not the first Green. Well, maybe she was the first Green to go from the Greens to the NDP, at least in terms of endorsements. Both have also been rumored or hoped by some as like future challengers to Ken Sim as mayoral.
That's definitely candidates. The interesting thing here. So, like, to kind of dip into the Canby Report territory slightly here. Like, the most interesting thing about this is if Boyle does get the nomination, not only does that mean a by-election that one city is, I'd say, unlikely to win, just because I don't think there anyone is, except like the big established, or basically, I think ABC is the only one that's like really scaled up enough to run a single seat citywide campaign at this point in terms of resources and everything. Anyway, I think it's unlikely they'd retain the seat if Boyle leaves it, which does mean that basically the default opposition party becomes the Greens, which is less desirable if you care about housing or making a city that is actually a city and not trying to pretend Vancouver is some idyllic small town that it hasn't been for over a century.
Yep, I'm going to talk about that with Matthew tomorrow for sure.
But that's I think the biggest potential impact here, because I think Boyle like gets housing a little more, but it's the legislature. Like, you're not going, it's going to be a party line vote. And assuming neither of them gets made housing minister in the next cabinet, like, it really is not going to fundamentally change kind of policy at the provincial level. So the main political impact is going to be locally on Vancouver City Council if Boyle does get the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, both of these people would be strong voices for Vancouver Little Mountain. Like, they're both well qualified and have, very interesting careers in politics and prior to that. And it'll be really interesting to see who wins this. It's nice to see a nomination race won. So far, many of the nominations we've seen announced from all the parties, I think, have just been acclamations. There haven't been too many, at least public races. And two, that it's, well, I don't even know that they're going to hash it out over ideas, because I think they're pretty
close.
It's
going to be who signs up more.
Yeah.
Like, that's
what
really
they all
what
are.
These
but
yeah. It is kind of weird that the former Green is the, kind of feels like the establishment candidate, where the you've seen Boyle very well connected in with the NDP circle and like that general progressive milieu, is kind of like the challenger or the outsider almost. It's a weird situation.
I think it's more a generational thing on that. I don't like it's there. It is amusing that Reimer used to be a Green, but Gregor Robertson was an NDP MLA before he became mayor and worked closely with Reimer for the entire time they were on council. And so I don't think Reimer is hostile in any way to the BC NDP, especially post 2017, this version. And George Heyman, it sounds like, reached out to Reimer specifically. That's not to say he endorsed her, but it is more like she'd be good.
Yeah, it's more that Boyle seems like the more like insurgent outsider.
But she's got
that's like the weird part.
Yeah.
Than Reimer being inside the tent.
Well, from the nominations setting up for the next election to what's happening in the legislature right now, I keep watching for some juicy, exciting bills to come forward so we can talk policy stuff. And we've been getting, I'm not going to say like insubstantial bills, but ones I'm not that interested in. Ones that are fairly short or make technical changes. There was a bill introduced today that helps the First Nations in Haida Gwaii by transferring assets of a trust to a different society, which is, I'm presuming, good. But in the grand scheme of things,
neither of us know for sure. But like, the point is, it's like very narrowly tailored.
Yeah, it's not like overhauling First Nations relations in BC, but it might help one. The most substantive bill, I guess, is changes to a couple bills relating to poverty and people with disabilities. And this is also kind of a technical bill that doesn't... It's the longest so far. It updates the targets on our poverty reduction strategy to say we want to reduce overall poverty by 60%, child poverty by 75%, and seniors poverty by 50% from 2016 levels in the next 10 years, which is positive. It's not, I'm not sure why seniors poverty is a lower number. We might, there might just be less seniors poverty to reduce.
Seniors are the wealthiest demographic in the country.
Sure, but there are still poor seniors.
There are still poor seniors, but like if you're going... The rate of poverty is lowest among seniors.
And the how on that is TBD, because we will release a new poverty strategy, poverty reduction strategy later this spring. Tied into this bill are changes to the Employment and Assistance Act and the Employment and Assistance for Persons with Disabilities Act. It says those haven't been updated since 2002. There's a number of changes here that basically affect how people on income assistance or disability assistance are supported to find and keep jobs. And it sounds like this is in line with what the 10,000 people who responded to surveys on this answered. But I haven't read enough critiques or, you know, analysis of this to say if this is a very strong positive way, or if this is more of a minor tweak, or if, I don't know, for some reason this is a terrible bill. But I'll be really curious to see what comes in the strategy in the spring, which presumably is the next 2 months. I guess.
Yeah, there really is not much to say on this. Updating targets, they can really say anything there. Like, it's all going to depend on what the actual policy things that get rolled out as a result. So in some ways, it's, you know, this bill could have been a press release in that sense, in terms of the main consequentialness of it.
Other than
at least with respect to that bit. Although, still, you know, I suppose good to have it, you know, the House formally say, yeah, this is what we want to do. But yeah, a little inconsequential on that front. Yeah, and if the other stuff hasn't been updated in 20 years, probably good to give those a once-over, but the actual changes are technical enough. I don't really have much insight into how good they're going to be.
And finally, on the provincial side, the BC Court of Appeal has issued a ruling that the injunction that was issued earlier this year, I believe, around Bill 34, the Public Consumption of Drug Use Act that the province tried to bring in, that injunction can stand, and the government still can't use its new law pending the full hearing in the court.
December 29th of last year is when the original one was
decision right. was released. Yeah, I talked about this with Dustin Godfrey on the podcast a few weeks ago. I do recall.
It's also weird because the bill itself only takes effect after Lieutenant Governor and Council promulgates a regulation to the effect that it comes into effect, and that hasn't happened yet. So they're like enjoining a bill that is not in effect. There's some weirdness all through this. So in this case, the decision didn't really touch on any of the substantive issues the province raised in their appeal on it. Not a legal expert here, so if any lawyers forgive me if I get this wrong, but reading through the decision, looks like it got decided on some pretty narrow technical grounds on basically, this isn't really going to change anything on the ground because, like I said at the start, this it's not actually in effect yet. And at the same time, all of the, you know, substantive matters of law that the province is raising and kind of the factual disputes on the previous decision, that's all going to get adjudicated in the actual case itself. So in the interest of not dragging this thing out and spending a bunch of judicial resources as well as like the individual parties' resources, we're just going to let the thing stand and not worry about briefing this whole thing through and hearing it, and you know, let that be the actual trial judge's job to figure out those things in the actual case, not just the preliminary injunction at the start of the case. So it's hardly a resounding this is, you know, the judge got it right when he granted the injunction. It also isn't a judicial activism run amok either. It's a very narrow decision from my reading of it, and just kind of it'll go ahead and get sorted out when the main body of the case gets heard.
Which I guess is what we'll have to look forward to eventually. Let's jump to federal politics for a few stories. One weird one this week is a program that I don't think either of us really knew that much about.
I vaguely heard about it.
Okay, this is like a rural and northern communities settlement program as part of Immigration Canada, where the federal government partners with municipalities to land immigrants there who are committed to living in small town Canada long term, and the community can set up its own rules or preferences or priorities and guidelines around whether to recommend the people to permanent residency or not.
Yeah, it sounds like basically just an additional immigration tract that people can get in on. So government's expanding it, which, cool. As long as it's not the case where the government is basically saying, okay, we have, this many, and you guys don't want some, you can we can ratchet down our numbers if these places don't like it. As long as it's an opt-in and we'll up the cap and for this specific stream, that all seems good. Especially because small town Canada is not exactly growing a lot, particularly if the places that are not in the exurbs of a major urban center.
I see the point of the program. My whole hesitation is around the powers given to local communities to yay or nay potential PR applications, because that feels like there could be a ground for abuse there. People who are immigrants are often in quite precarious situations, especially if there are parties beyond just Immigration Canada who have control over their ability to stay in the country. This is a big problem with the temporary foreign worker program, is people can't complain about this, working conditions because they risk being deported because their work permit gets pulled by their employer. And so I don't trust small town governments to make the best decisions, having seen covered small town governance for a little bit and looked at some of them. Some are probably great and doing great. It's a weird program from that end.
Are, individually voting on each applicant.
But this they might be.
This reads more like these are the, qualities we're looking for, the prerequisites for going into this program as a resident of this place, much more than a, hey, what does a mayor and four councillors think of, Bob over here who just came through here?
Oh, yeah. They're also expanding or launching a Francophone community immigration pilot this fall to increase the number of French-speaking newcomers in Francophone minority communities outside of Quebec. This would be your...
Yeah, so
Say Morinville, Northern Alberta, but other communities like that.
Well, there's a fairly sizable Franco-Ontarian population.
Yeah, for sure.
As well as New Brunswick. Quebec has its own immigration trap as well. So, I would suspect this much more follows that, where it's, hey, Quebec wants to place more emphasis on Francophone language ability than the standard immigration process would allow. So, yeah, we're going to tweak some of the stuff for this particular stream here. I suspect that that is much more what this is.
Indeed. Interesting program, especially at a time when immigration is quite under scrutiny.
Well, I think it's the small town fact, I think, is pretty key here because.
For sure.
Like most of, Canada for decades now has had a below replacement rate, birth rate. So yeah, small towns that are not major immigration destinations will have stagnant or shrinking populations for the most part, just at an aggregate level. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions here and there, particularly areas experiencing resource booms and the like, but yeah. As like a generalized fact, I would expect small towns to not be facing the same population growth pressures that the big cities where most Canadians actually live are facing.
The communities...
So like, the big push that the big main thing that is causing the pushback against immigration right now is just not in play in these places.
Among the participating communities, you have Vernon, BC, as well as West Kootenay together, which is Trail, Castlegar, Rosslyn, Nelson. Claire's home is the only place in Alberta. There's a few in Ontario, notably Thunder Bay and Sault Ste. Marie. It does say on the website what you can expect from a community. The pilot is community-driven. Communities will assess prospective candidates who best fit the economic needs of the community, have genuine employment opportunities that meet the community requirements, have the intention of staying in the community, and communities will recommend candidates for permanent residence to IRCC for a final decision. So final decision does stay with the federal government, but the initial recommendation, it sounds like, is coming from the community via their processes. Interesting. Next up, a little bit of an update on the ArriveCan mess and the ongoing contractor fiasco. Turns out, some of these Dalian Enterprise, the one we mentioned last year or last week from the former DND
but he's only suspended at the moment.
Suspended,
so technically still a DND employee, just on suspension.
I'm not clear now, having read this, why he needs to work at Department of National Defense, because it turns out he's gotten more than $200 million in government contracts. In 10 years.
From the sounds of it, the ability to navigate the system is probably a large part of... I hesitate to use the word value add here because there really is not any value being added by this, but the competitive edge, that's probably the better way to phrase it, was the familiarity with the government processes. So the actual being at D&D may have been the more about the information gained than the salary earned, of this is as reported. Yeah, because it turns out the guy got $200 million worth of contracts has flowed through his company over the past several years.
The taps are turned off, though. Public Service and Procurement Canada announced on Friday it had suspended working with his company on existing or future contracts. Part of that is by changing some of the security statuses. Oh, that was for GC strategies as well.
Strategies.
Yeah. Dalian is just shut down. So they're starting to crack down and find ways to prevent some of these contractors from bidding on things in the future, which is interesting because they haven't even said they necessarily did bad work. It's just unclear what work they did.
I feel like charging $200 million and not being able to like clearly explain what the work you did was is kind of bad work inherently.
It might be the government is really bad at scoping contracts with all of these agencies, and that
true
is
things
worth
can
a,
be true.
Yeah. All of that is bad news for the federal government and the Liberals, which is possibly why, but also possibly it was just a super safe riding that Jamil Javani wins the by-election in Durham to replace Aaron O'Toole.
Here's what I was going to win. Like I said, it's pretty much a safe conservative seat. It is notable here that this is the highest vote share that the conservatives have gotten, I think, pretty much ever in the riding. Yeah, standard Barely. Caveats on by-elections, but yeah, it is their strongest showing in the riding. It's also the Liberals' weakest in quite some time, I think since at least 2011. It is their weakest showing. And in general, the Liberals have been on long-term downward trend in the riding.
Turnout was about 27%, so I'm not reading anything into this. I bet if I'm a Liberal voter in a place that is pretty strongly conservative, I'm like just not feeling motivated to vote in this by-election, and it seems like that's what happened. Like, all of the parties got way less votes than they got in the 2021 federal election. The conservatives did better in not losing as many votes. Actually, the PPC, I think, kept a good number of their votes, but they still lost ground.
Half the voters. Which is worse than the conservatives, who only lost about a third of their voters from the previous one.
Giovanni's an interesting guy. I kind of come across him a number of years ago because he wrote a book on like male aggression that I thought might be interesting. And then like he got involved in discussing like police reforms in Toronto. And I was like, that's kind of interesting. And then he got involved in like the Doug Ford government consulting with them. And then he burned that bridge out and he's like started going on more of a culture war thing since. And now like in his first speech, I saw that he was like roasting, you know, the elites. And he said the Liberal elites are even in Queen's Park, or, you know, somehow blasting the education ministry he used to work for. So he's,
it's on the more populist side. I think that's,
yeah, a, but weirdly, like, wasn't always. Maybe he fascinates me a little bit.
He has an interesting biography, grew up very disadvantaged. I recall reading that, or hearing that he was functionally illiterate fairly late into adolescence or possibly even early adulthood. I'd have to double check, but, you know, kind of a real case of pushing past all of those barriers and really emerging as a, well, that bit of a political star. Just a very interesting story to him, for sure. Going to be someone to watch in the coming years. And guess probably starting to add creative positions, likely on the shortlist for a cabinet slot, would be my guess.
I wouldn't even venture predictions on that side yet, but definitely among the more interesting new conservative caucus members. So congrats, Jamil Giovanni. You didn't lose the sure bet.
I have seen some talk, though, of what this means for Trudeau. And, you know, on one hand, you know, by-elections, governments never do well. The fact that this is their worst showing in the riding in a long, long time, I think it has. I've seen some talk that that's going to put some renewed pressure on Trudeau to take that walk in the snow.
I think the polls tell us a lot more than a foregone conclusion kind of situation.
Yeah, they did campaign in this. This wasn't one where they, you know, just never bothered showing up to. They did put some effort into it, so it's, you can't just write it off entirely, even if it was a, yeah, pretty sure bet. It's more about what the margin says than the fact that they didn't win it.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, like you said, the polls, I think, are the bigger thing. But, you know, singular events have a way of sharpening attention more than individual polls or more than a string of polls do. So I don't know. Might have some stuff there. I'd still put money on Trudeau going into the next election, even though I'm far from convinced that's the best play for the Liberals. Not that they necessarily have any good ones.
The NDP didn't do good either, to be clear. Wasn't going to be there.
Nobody expected them to.
Yeah.
But I don't think the NDP made a big show of trying to campaign there. They were pretty silent on this, which puts them ahead of the Liberals on that front, in that the fact that they got the result everyone was expecting is less embarrassing because they didn't actually make any effort on it. Some minor kerfuffle a few weeks back when Prime Minister in some speech, I think it was a speech to caucus at a retreat. I'm a little fuzzy on the details here off the top of my head, but took a few shots at then candidate Giovanni. So, Ranveer Singh, totally silent. So it's, the Liberals look weaker as a result than the NDP do, even though the Liberals got a better result on this.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Thanks for listening.